Hello and welcome to The Restless Education. I'm David Marshall.
I'm Ross Borthwick.
And I'm Isabel Rich.
So today we're talking about curiosity, sparked, I might add, by a point made in the last episode on senior schools curriculum by our guest Neil Birch. Ross, I believe you were talking about the roof of Dunkeld Cathedral. Can you recall the moment for us?
Yeah, I mean, I love nothing more than to talk about Dunkeld Cathedral, so let's go. So we were walking around the cathedral and my daughter, who is quite young, asked a question as to why it only had half a roof. And so I naturally, as a history teacher, wanted to jump in and say, well, darling, it's because of the Reformation. And of course, that doesn't quite cut it with a toddler. I suppose I didn't really answer that question very well to her. But then it did make me think on the way home in advance of the pod with Neil Birch about the fact that actually the world around us is quite difficult to access in a deeper way unless you've received some quite specific education. So for instance, with the Reformation, you would have to have studied quite a limited part of our curriculum, and it would only be, let's say, A-level history. And I think Neil's riposte was quite good in that he said, well, actually, it's the curiosity, it's the confidence and the will to ask the question that's important, not the knowledge about the Reformation itself. And so I think he gave the example, well, you can just get your phone out and Google it. You know, why does Dunkeld Cathedral not have a roof? And so that led on to what has become this podcast.
It's a pretty big topic. And I love that this conversation that you had in the previous episode has led on to this, because it got us chatting a lot, didn't it? And it got us thinking about curiosity and asking questions, which maybe is the whole point. Let's chat about curiosity, because it's a big topic.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to think about what actually is curiosity. Curiosity to what? Are we talking just about academic curiosity, or does it stretch into the arts and sport and the world around us? It's kind of broad, isn't it? What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think we're all teachers, or we've all taught, and we're familiar with that curiosity in the classroom and perhaps different methods of encouraging that and stifling that. You know, a couple of us are parents as well, so we can look at this more holistically. We can think about perhaps just life as adults outside of school as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I definitely feel that to kind of talk about curiosity and how we kindle it in children, we need to be thinking about school, obviously, because that's what we're here for. We're teachers. But it's so important to think about how it can be done at home as well, because I do think that has a massive impact on a child's innate curiosity in myself.
And I wonder as well, just jumping in with this thought that, you know, if parents are curious and modelling that sort of that in front of their children, how much influence that has.
Everything's influential. If we're saying childhood, this sort of big thing, probably everything is having an influence on a child's sense of curiosity. I wondered if there are some things that have to be in place really but so that curiosity can thrive. I was thinking about how a home has to be safe. A classroom has to be a safe place for a child. A playground has to be a safe place for a child. In order to have curiosity, you can't be curious when you're feeling any sort of fear, I don't think.
That's, so Maslow's hierarchy coming into play.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah, like, or, you know, obviously you have to be well fed. You can't be curious if you're feeling hungry. You know, if you come into school hungry and you haven't had joined breakfast club, I don't feel that's leads to curiosity, right? So there has to be some of those things in place.
Well, moving further up, you then have sort of nourishment, don't you? But it's not necessarily to do with food. It's whether you're, it's basically an absence of neglect and, you know,
love.
Yeah. And then once you've got those things, does that enable curiosity? But then I suppose the big question is, what do we actually mean by curiosity in the first place? And actually, is it the same thing as creativity?
And is it the same thing as just asking questions?
Maybe the sort of innate want to answer something oneself, or to get to the answer without being prompted in that direction, without being taught. Controversial.
Oh, Oh, that is controversial because I think you can be curious, but be happy for the answer or the information to be given to you, slightly spoon-fed or handheld. I don't think that makes you any less curious myself. I feel, particularly with my own children and children I've taught, they've been delightfully curious to know about something, but often they're then given that piece of information, whether it's from a book or from us explaining something. And I think that that form of curiosity is just as good as someone who's investigating and exploring for themselves.
I guess to clarify, I suppose what I meant was without the teacher directing you into the process of being curious in the first place, and particularly whether children are actually innately curious, I suppose is a bigger question.
I did come across an article from The Atlantic, which was about the Ivy League schools. I think I sent it to you, Isabel. I don't know if you got a chance to read it. It was really interesting. It was criticizing the meritocracy that in America that ends up with children and then young adults going into these Ivy League schools. One really interesting thing they had in there was about curiosity. It says, kids are born curious. One observational study that followed four children between the ages of 14 months and 5 years found that they made an average of 107 inquiries an hour. Little kids ask tons of questions, then they go to school, and the meritocracy does its best to stamp out their curiosity. In research for her book, The Hungry Mind, the psychologist Susan Engel found that in kindergarten, students express curiosity only 2.4 times every 2 hours of class time. By fifth grade, that was down to 0.48 times. And it asks what happened, seemingly to put the blame on us teachers. As parents, of young children, do you recognize this innate curiosity? Is that something you see?
Yeah, I think from day dot, really, they're experimenting and they're playing with everything. They want to know how things work, and then actually, as they become older, they become incredibly proud once they've worked something out, you know, and they're very keen to tell you. And they often actually find slightly unhelpful uses for things as well. No, I think we can certainly see that. Back to just what you're saying about, you know, the meritocracy and school stifling curiosity. I did see something recently about homeschooling and the rate at which homeschooling has taken off in the developed world. And I just wondered whether there was some sort of link there in terms of maybe society becoming aware that because schools, well, particularly in the Western world, have to be meritocratic, that, you know, more and more families are, as it were, opting out.
Clearly, the Ivy League article is correct and true. But I find that in the UK, particularly in the early years, there's such a level of importance put onto learning through play at school. I'm pretty confident that most reception classrooms that you go into in year one are really geared up to ensure that children are learning through exploration and through play. Like most reception classrooms I visit have got so many different zones of play, whether it's construction or role play or learning your letters and numbers in a really relaxed and unpressured way. I just find it fascinating that that's the statistic that comes out from the US. Maybe it's different there, but I didn't think it would be.
It's obviously age related, right? Because, you know, we can see in our own, I'm assuming that kindergarten and nursery and all of that over in the States are similar to here. We can see what you've just described is absolutely evident in the UK. But at the same time, we know about SATs, right? We know about the 11 plus, we know about Common Entrance, we know about GCSEs, etc. So the sort of higher up the tree you climb, I suppose the less opportunity there is for creativity and curiosity.
There are instances when we are dampening it down to prepare for assessments, but there are so many opportunities through the school day where we can foster curiosity. And I think it'd be great to talk about some of those now.
I think we should start with it back with EYFS, because it's true that the play idea, I think it comes from Montessori. I always had the impression that the centrality of play to EYFS, as we call it, early years, is somehow linked to Montessori. I'm not sure if that's true, but it's definitely there, you're right. And everything that's done in the reception or the nursery, when you go into these spaces, you notice that there's stuff going on in the playground, which is children making choices about what to play with and how to play. It's quite inspiring as a person who teaches 11-year-olds to visit a 4 or 5-year-old playground and see the kind of creativity that's going on there.
And I was just about to mention as well, I think playtime is key, isn't it? And I think that sort of unstructured play just is reduced and reduced and reduced as pupils get older. Because even if they're at the same school and they have the same length of break time, there are more and more times when their, I suppose, free time would be eroded through whether it's study or, you know, they have peripatetic lessons or clubs or hobbies or activities where, and all of those things are brilliant, by the way, but they are more structured, and therefore there's less space, I suppose, in the school week for unstructured, well, play, for want of a better word, but, you know, time where you can just be and do whatever it is you want to do. I think as you get older, there's less and less of that.
Yeah, I think playtime's a really interesting part of the day, isn't it? You've talked about the joy of unstructured play, David, where the children really are just using the surroundings to create a game. And I must say that in a different way, I've really enjoyed some of the playgrounds I've visited, where they recognise that not all children can cope with such lack of structure. And in fact, they have put into their playgrounds things like these creative stations, which are sheds, which are full of things like chalk and paper and pens and things, so that actually for those children that can't cope with that form of activity, there's an alternative thing to do at break time that still could kindle curiosity and creativity, but just maybe in a different way. And I'm so glad that those sort of activities exist as a bit more of a crutch for those that are more intimidated by playtime.
I don't know if we want to sort of move on to focus on different playtime activities, but, you know, obviously here I'm in a senior school. We don't have a climbing frame like we've just discussed, but, you know, maybe we should do. But one thing we had recently, we had some prep school pupils come and visit us for an outdoor day, and actually Tom Mason, who was on this pod earlier in the season, he and I took a group on our mountain bike track. So we've got quite an extensive purpose-built mountain bike track here. And these pupils had never been on a mountain bike before. And they were, I suppose, quite intimidated by the prospect. But of course, there's an option. So every time you get to a difficult bit, for want of a better word, there's an easier route, you know, and there's always like the green run option. And they just absolutely loved it. And through no pressure at all from us, every single child attempted, by the end of the morning, attempted the difficult route, just because why wouldn't you once you'd mastered the easy one? And I think like having facilities like that, where there's like a degree of challenge that you can opt into, I think is pretty important.
And you can create that in the classroom as well. I mean, you know, we haven't talked about the classroom, but obviously fostering questioning, you can build in ways of getting children to come up with different types of question and better questions. And I feel also that what you're talking about with tracks, that reminds me very much of the chili challenges that we did. Do you remember that, Isabel?
Yes, I certainly do. It was such a no-risk way of allowing children to choose their own level of difficulty for a task. Basically, it was done on the strength of chilies, mild, medium, or hot. And if you were feeling a little nervous about an activity, you could just choose the mild one. But if you were feeling like a real challenge and a little bit confident, you could go for the hot chili challenge. And it was great. It was no risk. Choose what you want to do for yourself. But I agree. I think if you look around at curiosity and how to engender it in a classroom, this concept of questioning comes up time and time again, whether it's encouraging the children to ask questions and then allowing space and time for those to be answered. But also, I really liked another thing that we did when we all worked together, which was there was a phase of not using a learning objective or a WALT, but instead we had to frame it as a question. So it would be rather than we are learning about speech marks today, which sounds like a snoozathon, it would be How do we use speech marks? And it is amazing how suddenly something that can be a little bit nitty-gritty and grammatical and boring suddenly becomes a bit more interesting. It sounds like an investigation. It sounds like you're bringing them on the journey with you. And it immediately also, as a teacher, makes you perhaps reframe how you're going to teach speech marks. In fact, what I ended up doing was giving the children loads of incorrectly punctuated speech. And they had to use that to try and figure out what the rules were for speech marks. And it became an investigation, and it became an enjoyable way of trying to learn the rules behind speech marks rather than me just doing chalk and talk and telling them. So I think there's a lot to be said about the power of questions. And it's just such an easy thing to do. It takes very little time as a teacher and pretty much no resources to just reframe how you're delivering your lesson.
Well, I think there's no coincidence, is there, that all of our podcasts are, I think pretty much all of them anyway, are in fact questions, you know, the titles of them. And also back to your sort of heat challenge or chili challenge, that was back in the day of sort of Nando's mania, wasn't it, back in London. So yeah, very popular with kids. So do we want to then think about how would we within school support curiosity maybe beyond the classroom? Almost, you know, let's say you have a child who's, let's not go down the speech mark route actually, but let's say you're doing something else. Let's say, David, you were talking about, you know, I don't know, Agincourt. You know, why was Henry V successful at Agincourt? And you've got someone really keen. And then what do they do when they leave the classroom at the end of it?
I think it's a question. Yeah, we can't separate the inside and the outside of a classroom, can we? Because we talk a lot on this podcast about culture. And it makes me think, Isabel, that everything that you were just saying there was a lot about the teacher, the role of the teacher and the skills of the teacher to plan the lessons, to get them set up in the right way, to understand that there is a need for different levels, but also to allow the children to make choice about these things. And I think the skills of the teacher mean that when the child leaves the classroom, there's still something fizzing away. And that's always been my aim with when I'm teaching, I don't know about Agincourt, but Shakespeare or something similar, is that because the language is so good, I know that if I can just get it in the right way, that's not too challenging, but it's manageable, the children will be going around for the rest of the week or the month or even the year or the rest of their lives even, muttering them to themselves, little bits of Romeo and Juliet, because you cannot get it out of your head, because it's in there. And much in the same way, I imagine that you come out going, yeah, but what about this? There's got to be some sort of element of us setting them up for them to be able to explore something themselves, or for them to be able to kind of draw on it in future. And we've definitely covered this before in lots of different ways, but it strikes me that there's a skill in the teacher right there. And I one thing I really love as a technique is the teacher pretending that they don't know, or, you know, the teacher in role. The great one is like, oh no, I've mucked up and I've accidentally mixed up these pronouns and these verbs. What are we going to do? Can anyone help me? The children know that you're fooling them. They know it, but they want to play along with it. So they're going to help you, in inverted commas, sort out these pronouns and verbs. Or another example might be that you step into role as Macbeth's spin doctor, and you come into the classroom and you say, you know, thank you for joining us here today. Look, I just want to say on behalf of the Macbeths, they're really grateful you're here. And obviously they will be fully compliant with the press and the authorities in answering any questions, and encouraging the children to start asking questions. And the children sort of take a while, but then they get into it. And then they start getting more and more fierce, because as they step into role as reporters who are really determined to get the truth of this Macbeth, Lady Macbeth ploy of keeping hidden all the secrets, there's that curiosity comes out in the way in which they're playing the game. And I think this is where we talked about play, you know, earlier on. This is where curiosity and play intersect, because it's setting it up so that they're in the game. And as you saying, Ross, then what happens outside the classroom? How do we How do we keep that game going in their heads or in the way they move either at home or around the school? I don't have an answer. I haven't answered your question at all, I'm sorry, but I think there's a game there, but the game has got to go beyond the classroom.
Making it fun, right? And and I think all the techniques you've described are just exemplary, teaching techniques, aren't they? And I think we touched upon it a bit in our first ever episode on gamification, but there's a bit more to it. And I'm sure, David, you must have so many people wandering around in their various lives now who can just reel off, when Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane. So, what do we do then when they're intrigued? They want to know more. Is it enough for them to simply know more? And as a recent guest of ours said, get their phone out. Are we content? Is that job done? Or do actually we as educators in schools, do we need to be providing other avenues? And what could those avenues look like? What is best practice?
I think it has to be a partnership with home at that point, because there's only so much a teacher can do. And if you've got a very curious and able child and they're particularly interested in a topic, I think it would be great to tell home about it and suggest maybe they could do a project together at home. To extend their knowledge. I think that'd be an amazing thing to do. And to be honest with you, I have a very able niece who is innately curious, and she is fueled with information at school, but equally is just as hungry to find it at home and pretty much herself. She has two working parents, but wherever she can, she's reading a book or she's watching how to create some artistic endeavor on YouTube. Or when you take her on an adventure to go to a museum, she's reading every signpost that there is in the place. So she's the sort of child that will just self-propel. I guess for me, the people who perhaps are even more important are those that aren't naturally that willing to be so curious, perhaps particularly when it comes to the academics. And again, I do think, therefore, that school has a huge role to play. Again, it's back to being an amazing teacher and doing the sort of things we've been talking about and being enthusiastic, but also really going beyond that as a teacher a little bit. I've seen some fantastic ways that kind of Key Stage One teachers have launched their topic. Loads of schools do their kind of cross-curricular topics for a term or half a term, whether it's the Great Fire of London or the Stone Age, that sort of thing. I've seen some really innovative ways that they've launched that. That doesn't take much work, but it has meant that my child has come home and goes, "Oh my goodness, Mummy, the Gruffalo had upturned the entire classroom." And this was the beginning of their woodlands topic in year one. And it immediately hooked them in, and she was really excited to go to school. And there have been stories about the Great Fire of London of children building Tudor houses and then them burning them outside in the playground so they could kind of see how quickly a fire would go. So it's these little tricks that do require a bit of time and prep, but not masses, that really ignite curiosity in children.
That was a great pun, by the way. No, so I was just going to say, in terms of
Wait, what
like
was the pun? I missed it.
ignite, you're talking about burning
Oh,
models of
I
London
totally get
outside
it
and
now. Thank you for explaining.
sorry.
I wish it was purposeful.
I'll let you have that one now. So within school, what do excellent teachers do? Well, if we go back to the sort of English analogy, rather than just leaving them to their own devices, maybe writing a report, mentioning at parents' evening they love Shakespeare, or signposting them to something. What about actually taking them somewhere, doing something with them, whether it be optional or compulsory? Every school's different in terms of resources, but that classic English literature trip to Stratford-upon-Avon. We're miles away from Stratford-upon-Avon, but our kids absolutely loved schlepping down there and getting a weekend's worth of Shakespeare. And I think, it's those moments that they will remember. They probably won't remember their lessons, but they will remember the trip with Mr. Such and Such to the Globe or whatever it is. I think having an outlet in various different aspects of their education that they can then opt into is, for me, what we should all be doing as institutions.
I remember my trips at school so distinctly. We got taken to Granada Television. I don't think Granada Television exists anymore, but it's I think we also saw Coronation Street set on that same trip. And then another trip was going to the National Coal Mining Museum in Wakefield. We got to go down a coal mine and everything. So yeah, I had some great trips as a child, and they stand out. I bet. Do you remember your trips, Isabel Ross?
Oh, I certainly do. What I like about some of the schools I go around today is that not all trips have to be really far away and really expensive. And quite a few of the schools that I visit really talk about how they use their local area for trips. So it just, I think getting out of the classroom, but doing something that's relevant to whatever you're teaching the children just makes such a difference. I mean, when I was at secondary school, I remember going to draw pictures in the gardens of our school grounds. And that's not a trip, is it? But it was outside the classroom. It's actually looking at flowers in the sunshine. And I really remember that. And that has got to have encouraged me to be more curious about drawing and developing a skill that wasn't something I was naturally very good at, but I really, really enjoyed it and valued that experience.
Every single museum in the country has an artifact box that they'll loan out to schools for, I think, for nothing if you're a state maintained school, and there might be a sort of paltry charge if you're an independent school. You know, it's how you use the resources that are available to you. I was down at our prep school just a couple of weeks ago, and I was just crossing the playground, and there was a bloke there, a Roman soldier, standing there, and had them all formed up in a testudo, and you know, they're obviously studying the Romans, and I just thought, you don't need to schlep everyone down to Hadrian's Wall, which is what I would do at the drop of a hat, but there is a cost there, and not just in financial terms. Whereas actually maybe just getting someone in or having an enthusiastic teacher who can deliver that, and they will remember that moment for probably the rest of their lives. Yeah, absolutely spot on about encouraging all of that. And really, you've highlighted, Isabel, that it doesn't need to be massively costly.
And the other thing alongside trips that I think is so valuable and something that schools have just got stronger and stronger at doing so, particularly obviously the independent schools, but definitely now more the state secondaries, is all the clubs that are on offer now. Most of the schools I visit have just the most incredible range of clubs for people to get involved with, whether it's from Warhammer to Dungeons and Dragons, knitting and nattering, taekwondo fencing. The range is huge, and it's a great way for students and pupils to get involved in a totally no risk way. And I think people are realizing that that could just spark and ignite a bit of curiosity in a child that they want to go and explore it more.
So we are huge on that. You know, we want pupils who are interested in a particular area not just to enjoy it for themselves, but to end up actually with a qualification in that particular area. You know, an example might be someone joining us in the third form, not having been up a Munro, and then leaving in the upper sixth, having actually started their mountain leader qualification or even winter mountaineering. And you know, that's just an example of, I think, what we want to be encouraging and how we view education.
I do want to ask, because we increasingly talk about this in almost every episode, internet, smartphones, AI. We mentioned earlier how you can just Google something now. And of course, that's something that, well, you know, you get the answer immediately, right, to a factual question. You might ask, why is the roof of Dunkeld Cathedral half on, half off? And you Google it, and if you have a phone in your pocket, an adult can answer that question pretty quickly. Is it killing curiosity to have all of these devices? And then AI, is there a potential that that could in some way dampen curiosity?
It's interesting, isn't it? I was considering about my own form of curiosity, which is, oh, it's pretty Googletastic, I'm not going to lie. And I was thinking about that and thinking that my level of curiosity is perhaps a little bit superficial, a bit scattergun, a bit too broad. I guess maybe that's because I don't have the time, because I'm a busy mum and also trying to earn my keep, to really delve down and think too deeply about anything. So I spend quite a lot of time Googling random stuff for me and the children to answer questions that may come along. Is that still being curious? Yeah, it is to a certain degree. It's a little on the superficial side, but I feel that's okay, because maybe if we answered that superficial question, it might encourage us at a later time to delve down a bit deeper and explore something a little more, maybe.
Yeah, I don't think there's any shame in having like a superficial level of knowledge and of lots of things, is there? I mean, ultimately, it's still you being curious and still being motivated enough to find out an answer, even if it doesn't lead you to understand it in a deeper way. But then it really comes down to individual preference and what is worth your time. You know, you've just said you're incredibly busy. It's not possible to be expert in everything, and maybe it's not favorable to be either. What I would just throw into the mix is there any danger in us all being superficially, not expert, but superficially sort of knowledgeable, you know, perhaps feeling like we're knowledgeable in areas where really we're not. And I suppose the classic sort of adage is there's nothing so dangerous as a little bit of knowledge. And I don't know whether we feel that that's still a thing.
I think that one area that I'm superficially knowledgeable about is plant life, flowers and that sort of thing, because I've got a phone. So when I was taking a residential trip in May in Devon, I had an app which could, you know, take a photograph and identifies the flower or the leaf. And that was great. I loved it. But if you ask me now, what are any of those flowers, out of the sort of 15 that I looked up, I could probably name one of them and maybe identify it at a push. Is that a problem? Not really, because I for that period of time, I was really interested in the flora and fern of Devon. I think I'm still interested in that. I don't have any knowledge without a phone. So put me in a field in the middle of nowhere and I wouldn't be able to tell you anything. I also, by the way, wouldn't be able to find my way home because I would need a map on my phone to do that. And maybe that's a stark difference with 100, 200 years ago.
It's so interesting what you say, David, about using a phone. And as I was talking about that, I use one frequently. Although what I am making an effort to do for my kids at home, which is, I guess, a point of generating curiosity in the home rather than at school, is to buy some of those old-fashioned Dorling Kindersley non-fiction books on topics like nature or the body, and history, to sort of encourage the idea that we can still use books to gain knowledge. And actually, when I did buy the entire history book of Dorling Kindersley, which sort of does a period per double page, even just having a double page spread on a particular era, it felt so much more mindful to be looking at that than going onto the computer. And there's definitely such a space within the home to encourage curiosity away from a screen. It's a great supplementary activity, but I still think there's the power of books, the power of amazing and informative TV shows to build and spark curiosity in a way that the internet can do, but in a slightly different way myself.
What we are talking about is skill loss, but also access through the internet and our phones to a much greater area of corpus of knowledge. But if we're talking about curiosity, I think that what's important about, you know, humans going forward in the future, whether we have the current technology or I'm sure something different, is that we are always looking around us and asking questions about things, which mean that we don't get stuck in the past, and we also don't get stuck in the present, in the sense that we aren't assuming that what's happening now is always going to be the case. You know, just because this is the way the world works, just because we have all of this now, it doesn't mean that this is going to be the case. And I think when you have curiosity, you look at things and you say, you know, what if, as well as how does that work, or as well as you know, where does this come from? You're kind of saying there is the possibility for something different. And if we're looking ahead to the problems that we see in our current time will be affecting us in the future, such as climate change, the question, you know, the questions of how do we do this differently, or what if we did this, are really important ones, not just for children to be asking, but for adults, for researchers, for scientists, for government leaders, because they point us towards a different way of doing things. And so whatever we say about technology or children's development in school and outside of school, we know that adults need curiosity too, for sure. And also, I think to be happy people, we need curiosity.
Do you remember the classic sort of introduction to source work lessons when you were a pupil, or what in, indeed as a teacher?
Well,
One of the
is it something like, looking at details, asking
it,
questions?
trying to identify sources of information. Why has this been written? Who's it been written by? What's the purpose of this particular source? What is it trying to get the reader or the viewer to do or to think? And I think that was always fairly accessible when using a paper source or a video source or but I think the modern world now, I think particularly with the advent of AI, it's made the pupil's job in terms of like identifying whether a source is reliable or not so much more difficult. And I do worry that, because yes, obviously we can satisfy our own curiosity by Googling something or by asking Alexa, but where's Alexa getting that information from? And if we can't scrutinize those sources of information in the way that we can do before, then what are we learning, I suppose, is my concern. And I could even go as far as to say, and who wants us to learn it?
Oh, golly, there's conspiracy theories there, Ross. So, Ross definitely doesn't think that the way to future-proof curiosity is via the medium of a smartphone. So, how are we going to make sure that children continue to be curious?
I come back to the original thing. I think it's innate. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, a bit like when we talked about Maslow's hierarchy, it gives all of the things that children should have. And this was put together, I think it was in the 80s. And Article 31, children have the right to play. If we're coming back to future-proofing curiosity, having the right to play, having a childhood, and the things that you need to be safe and happy. Not being in a conflict zone, to having food, to having love and shelter. And I think these things nurture curiosity in the home and also in school as well. I would say that's how we future-proof it.
And I think it's down to role models as well. Those role models ideally need to come from home and from school, but that's not always going to happen at home. So it's really important that teachers can really ignite and spark curiosity and the desire to want to know more. And that's a tough job if it's not happening at home, but it is possible to happen.
I think as well, in the hardest of settings, it's where it's most important, isn't it? Because it's even more important that you signpost opportunities or take those pupils on the sort of things that we've mentioned, because I suppose otherwise, how are they going to know that they exist? It sort of only takes one good influence, and I think that either comes from home or it comes from school, but there needs to be someone, I suppose, offering that or facilitating that opportunity. I think, yeah, going back to what we were saying about that wider offering, I just think that has to be really well done for me.
There was Matthew Side who talked about having a teacher in a club outside of school, a ping pong teacher, and that's how he became really good at ping pong, and now he's a writer and all sorts of things. But clubs as well, having outside school clubs, swimming clubs. I know a lot of the pupils I teach, they will do sort of swimming clubs, which is nothing to do with school, or they'll do lots of other things as well. And I think going back to what I said about the hierarchy and the rights of a child, it's also, I think, why we need to get involved in society and sort of support things, because it's a political question that there are children who are malnourished in this country and who don't have shelter over Christmas. And we know that. We're aware of this happening in our society, let alone in other countries. It's definitely something that I feel there's an obligation on people to know about and then to get involved in supporting and working to, I don't say eradicate poverty, but to definitely try and do our best to reduce it so that we can have children growing up into adults who are happy and curious.
Yeah, hear, hear. Completely agree with that. And perhaps we should now think about moving on to other ways that we can perhaps encourage curiosity, whether within or outside of the classroom. Can anyone remember their favourite game as a child?
Oh, I did have a little pre-think about this because I knew my mind would go totally blank if I was asked without having a think. And yeah, I can't remember there was one specific game that I totally adored, but I loved card games. I loved Scrabble. I loved Boggle. Oh, there was Cluedo, which I thought, oh yes, that is quite a curious making game because I'm literally deciding who murdered who in what room. That was very exciting. And then I did play a lot outside, and that really was generating a sense of curiosity because it was much more innovative. So I grew up in the middle of Wales in the 1980s, and there was not a lot going on then. So it was a childhood of building dams, and I even used to, get this, make patterns out of the cut grass clippings. God, I don't even know how I got to that, but I did. That's what I did. So a variety of traditional games were had by me in the middle of Wales.
I think it's the same for me too. I love building dens. I did go for a phase of lighting some fires, which sounds a bit worse than it was. It was mostly in like a coal scuttle. You could kind of create some great little fires going on. And yeah, dams as well. And they were great. And then also one thing I really enjoyed was just invention games, which were more about talking, where me and my sister would go for long walks following my parents somewhere. And we would just enter a world of make-believe where for maybe an hour on the walk, we'd create this sort of world through chatting together. And that sort of game felt, you know, it felt very real in some ways. You could create extraordinary stories and things together, which I can't remember much of it now, but it was really fun. What about you, Russ?
Yeah, I think no, like cross between the two of you, really, just this immense freedom, just a lot of time outside playing games as described, and you know, lots of making dens or, you know, various things. But it was the role play that I remember, and that then also crossed over into school as well, because the friendship group was the same, or, you know, more or less the same. And you then create, as you say, this sort of like this world that was sort of 7 days a week, you know. And yeah, I think it's having that. I just don't remember much adult supervision at all, like from a terrifyingly young age. And I think it's, what you're saying as well about making dams, you know, we were down on the beach trying to like literally hold the tide back by building all these walls out of, you know, we were putting sand mortar between rocks, and you know, there wasn't an adult in sight. And you just think, there's just no way that you'd see groups of like relatively small children just running around on their own now, for quite good reason, no doubt. But you know, I think it's that freedom that I remember.
That's lovely. And I also wanted to ask, what was the last time you were curious about something? And can you talk a bit about if and how you followed the trail?
Well, as I talked about before, I don't have huge amounts of time to be pursuing my own personal curiosities. They tend to be necessitated by need, really. I guess I have been curious with my own children to think out how best to entertain them, and doing a bit of research into sort of activities and games that they might like at the age that they are now. Oh, I tell you what else. I've just finished The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, and I have been very curious as to why it was so popular. That's how I initially started reading it. And then I got towards the end and I started to think, actually, yes, this book has grasped people and I can now see why. But I was extremely curious for the first two thirds of the book to work out why it had been such a phenomenon.
That's great. Ross, what about you?
Yeah, mainly nature based, I'd say. So I'm tapping some trees for sap at the moment, and something I haven't done before, having varied success, mainly to do with something to do with starting in the wrong season, but I suppose that's curiosity as well.
And, hold on, I have to stop you right now, Ross. I am now curious. Why are you tapping trees for sap? I don't know why that needs to happen.
To make syrup, maple syrup, and sycamore syrup, and birch syrup, and all that good.
That is very cool.
Yeah. So Obviously, you need a certain temperature range, which we have. The sap only runs at a certain time of year.
Wait,
So I think
wait, wait. I have a question. I have a question. Wait, you just said obviously you need a certain temperature, something. What? I don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean by obviously you need a certain temperature range?
So you need right, okay. So you need to be in freezing conditions at night, and then you need to be in positive numbers through the
Okay.
day. So, and you need that for a
That
particular period.
wasn't at all obvious to me. I don't know if it was to
Sorry.
Isabel, but it wasn't
Okay.
obvious.
Cold places basically is what you yeah. Oh, this is particularly geeky as well. So I last little one to make you chuckle. I had a go at writing a storybook actually for my daughter for Christmas. I had it, built online, Book Builder or whichever platform it was. So it'll arrive soon. I'll let you know whether it's any good. But it was just based on a quite a silly evening where I decided to put the lobster creel out in the dark, and I tried to be dissuaded by my father-in-law, and it just made for quite a funny rhyming book. Yeah, we'll see how that goes. But I'm not much of
Lobster
a
creel.
writer.
Wait, lobster creel is like the lobster pot you put that catches lobsters, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. You haven't asked me, but I'm going to say it anyway. I'm very ashamed of
Sorry,
what I
David.
was
I was
last
going to
curious.
jump in with, and
No,
you, David.
it's
Sorry.
fine. I will say it. I'm very ashamed of what I was last curious about, which is how many girlfriends has Leonardo DiCaprio had? And I googled it because obviously, like, how else do you find out? It's
So,
a
too
lot. It's a
many.
lot.
They're
Many,
also
many.
half his age now.
No, but they're not all. Well, they are now, but they're a real range. And because I've
Why
been
are you
watching
thinking
a
about that?
I was watching an old DiCaprio movie, Catch Me If You Can. This is one thing I do when I'm watching movies now, is I get IMDb up, the Internet Movie Database, and I look up who's in the film, and then obviously one thing leads on to another. So this is the danger of the internet, because I'm sitting there watching a movie while looking up stuff about the people in the movie.
So you're not really
And
watching it, you're actually just on your phone.
it's I am the worst example of all the terrible things that you were talking about to do with the internet. I am that bad example. But
I
I
am too,
think,
David. It's
yeah,
okay.
oh
My
good, it's
name's
not just me
Isabel.
then.
My name's Isabel, and I too Google things about films whilst I'm watching them. Often locations, period locations
That
is
sounds
a
more.
absolute it's great. I just still I almost want to finish this with wondering, because of Ross's enormous amount of curiosity in the world around him, when he ever has time to sleep. That is my biggest question that I'm going to
Sleep
leave this podcast with.
is a luxury. I do have a very good question. Can you have too much curiosity? You may
Well, I
want to cut that
think
out.
anyone who's got to this tail end of our podcast and is still listening, first of all, deserves some sort of prize. I wish we could give out like a certificate for the Resters Education Award for having got to the end of the podcast. So well done.
Tenacity.
Well, if you got this far, I think you should really give us 5 stars and sort of recommend us to other people. Secondly, you've learned a great load of stuff about us, particularly about Ross's great curiosity. Can you have too much of it? Maybe by the time people get to this point, they might have had too much of it.
Without a doubt.
Well, maybe it's time for us to end there. Who wants to do the honors?
Oh,
Isabel.
Surely.
Yes, you do. You can do it. You can do it. You just have to say you've been listening to The Rest Is Education.
You've been listening to The Rest Is Education. I'm Isabel Rich.
And I'm David Marshall.
And I'm Ross Borthwick.